You've probably been there. You studied hard for an exam, maybe even got a decent grade, but a few weeks later, the material feels like a complete blur. Or perhaps you've had that nagging doubt, wondering if you truly understood something or, if you just memorized enough to get by.
It's a remarkably common experience, and frankly, yeah, a bit unsettling. It's right at the heart of our deep dive today.
Exactly. Today, we're plunging into the fascinating and, yes, unsettling world of what our sources call ersatz learning and inauthentic testing. We're going to explore why students can succeed in courses without actually mastering the subject matter, the quiet consequences this has, and crucially, how we can foster a much deeper, more meaningful engagement with knowledge.
Our journey today draws on a foundational paper exploring ersatz learning, inauthentic testing, alongside more recent work on making mechanistic sense in biology, and even insights into the trivialization of science education.
Our mission is clear: to equip you with insights into what it truly means to be well-informed, and to really challenge some of those conventional notions of what we think learning looks like.
Right.
Okay, let's unpack this with a classic scenario that perfectly illustrates the problem.
Let's do it.
Imagine a math student faced with what's called the pit problem on an exam. It sounds like a pretty standard physics question.
Yeah.
Calculate the depth of a pit based on how long a dropped stone takes to hit the bottom. Sounds straightforward, right?
Yeah, it seems like a typical application of formulas.
You'd think so.
Yeah.
But this particular student was visibly upset, almost indignant, claiming, "We never did a single pit problem."
Ah, okay. So not recognizing it.
Exactly. And here's where it gets really interesting and a little bit alarming. This student's go-to study method involved finding model problems in their textbook.
Like templates.
Right, templates. Then just substituting values into those existing solutions and checking if their answer matched. If it did, the problem was solved.
And while that technique might get you a passing grade, our sources describe it as essentially worthless as a way of learning mathematics.
Oh,
Worthless.
yes.
That student's lament, never did a single pit problem, is a perfect example of ersatz learning. It's a substitute, you know? A substitute for real understanding.
So they're linking specific math operations to specific problem types.
Precisely. Rather than grasping the core concepts of motion problems themselves.
What's truly eye-opening is that if this student had simply adopted a second technique, drawing out the problem,
Just visualizing it.
yeah, just sketching it out, they would have immediately recognized it as just another motion problem, not some unique pit problem. They would have solved it correctly.
That simple difference in approach.
Yeah. And this brings us to the core thesis of our deep dive. Students can absolutely study without learning and still do passable work.
Because what they're engaging in is ersatz, or substitute, learning, not genuine mastery.
So if students are doing this ersatz learning, what does that mean for the tests they're taking? What kind of tests are we talking about here?
Well, that's where the concept of inauthentic testing comes in, a term coined by Wiggins.
Inauthentic testing.
Okay.
Our sources highlight that students succeed precisely because the tests they face often fail to measure actual mastery. Instead, these tasks measure other skills entirely,
Like.
like rote memorization or maybe the ability to spot connections between multiple choice questions, that sort of thing.
Okay, so give us a clearer picture. What's an authentic test versus an inauthentic one?
Right. Think of an authentic test as requiring a student to undertake a real, meaningful task.
Like an acting student performing a scene.
Exactly. That's a good example. In contrast, inauthentic tests confront students with questions that are purely contrived just for the exam's purpose.
And the pit problem is a prime example of that.
It really is. Let's be honest, no one in the real world measures a pit's depth by dropping a stone. You'd tie a string to it, right?
Right? Or use some other tool.
And the problem has almost nothing to do with how mathematicians actually use calculus. It's a made-up scenario designed only for testing.
What's fascinating is that students, even if they don't fully grasp the real discipline, they recognize unfailingly the artificiality of the pit problem.
Yeah, they sense it's a game, so they adapt. They study to pass these artificial tests.
And then faculty inadvertently reward their mastery of the appropriate ersatz knowledge with passing grades.
It becomes this cycle.
Yeah, and so much research confirms this, doesn't it? Students can often reproduce facts, they pass exams, yet they still lack understanding and hold on to significant misconceptions.
Absolutely. And it's not just about simple memorization. Our sources suggest students become incredibly adept at complex skills that bear upon passing science, humanities, and mathematics courses.
Wow, skills for passing.
But that really have little to do with mastering those subjects. These are all forms of ersatz learning.
Okay, so can we break down these ersatz techniques? You mentioned earlier our sources talk about clumps and shapes.
Yes, exactly. There's sort of two main categories for these coping mechanisms.
Let's start with clumps. What are those?
Okay, clumps are described as acritical responses. Basically, they involve amassing elements often found in genuine critical analyses, but crucially, minus their underlying logic.
So it looks like analysis, but it's missing the thinking part.
Pretty much. Think of data packing. This is producing a paper that's rich in information, but impoverished in thought.
Got an example.
Like, knowing Christopher Columbus discovered America, but without reflecting on the underlying assumptions of European primacy or, you know, the impact on indigenous populations, just stating the fact.
Right. One source calls this cow, the idea that a fact is a fact, which actually works against true understanding.
Yeah, it stops critical thought. Then there's jargon packing.
Using fancy words to sound smart.
Exactly. Using technical language to appear learned without really understanding the concept yourself, and assertion packing, confidently stating symbolic importance without proper quotes or appropriate terms, often just surrounded by wads of data that don't quite connect logically.
Okay, so those are clumps. What about shapes?
Shapes, on the other hand, mimic the logical forms of analysis, but again, without the substance.
So they look like the structure of an argument.
Exactly. This includes things like borrowed analysis, where a student just takes someone else's critical analysis and presents it wholesale.
Okay, basically plagiarism of ideas, if not words.
Or close to it, yeah.
Yeah.
You also see analysis confined arbitrarily to surface meanings, limiting an inquiry to only the most obvious features, like demonstrating truisms such as mothers influence their offspring without ever exploring the how or what behind that influence, just stating the obvious.
Right, no depth.
And finally, there's analysis of a single thread of meaning. This is about seeking only one technique or a single correct answer.
Like those math students who only want one way to solve a problem.
Exactly like that. Filtering out anything that seems confusing or contradictory to keep it simple.
Let's make this concrete with an example. Imagine an assignment to interpret Robert Frost's famous poem, Birches.
Okay.
An authentic reading would really grapple with its complexities, right?
Mm-hmm. Dig into the nuances.
But a student coping with this task might simply define it as showing whether it's a happy or a sad poem. Just boil it down.
Right. So one student might focus only on the delight of swinging birches, quoting lines about fun.
Data packing for the happy side.
Yeah. And another might emphasize loneliness and hardship, quoting about a pathless wood.
Data packing for the sad side.
Exactly. Both are picking out quotes that support their single idea and systematically ignoring elements that seem confusing or don't fit their neat little box.
But a genuine interpretation, the kind that truly reveals the poem's complexity, must seek out the most puzzling elements to understand how different patterns relate.
Like those lines, I'd like to get away from Earth a while and then come back to it and begin over.
Yeah, that brings in a whole different layer of longing and return, not just simple, happy, or sad. You can't just ignore it if you want to really understand.
Absolutely not. But the coping strategy involves precisely that, ignoring the complexity.
This reveals a real disconnect then. Our sources, referencing an Assumption College survey, found something interesting. While colleges' HOPE literature courses encourage future reading, 0.70% of students read 5 books or fewer outside of class in their senior year of high school.
70%? Wow.
Yeah. For them, it seems they're reading literature primarily to pass our courses.
That's quite a gap between institutional goals and student reality.
And when students were asked about their principal responsibilities, what they felt they should be doing.
What did they say?
They overwhelmingly prioritized mastering the informational content at nearly 40%.
Okay, getting the facts down.
An acquisition of critical skills at just over 35%. What came in last? Becoming scholars or developing their own interpretations.
So the deeper intellectual engagement was at the bottom of the list.
Right. And their assessment preferences are incredibly telling, too.
Let me guess. Multiple choice.
You got it. Students strongly preferred multiple choice and short answer tests, which, of course, emphasize data recall.
Makes sense if that's their priority.
and they showed a real aversion to oral reports and term papers.
The very tasks that demand assessing meaning and significance, the things that require deeper interpretation.
Exactly. And when it came to professors,
what did they want from them?
They ranked supportive of students highest.
Okay, wanting help and encouragement.
But where did competency in the field fall? Last.
Last. Wow.
And only a tiny fraction, 1.8%, chose encountering challenging teachers as a hope for their academic life. They weren't looking to be pushed hard.
It really paints a clear picture, doesn't it?
It does. Students largely view education as a means to pass courses and acquire usable skills, especially of a task-specific sort.
Practicality over intellectual curiosity, maybe.
Seems like it. They don't expect to become intellectuals or develop new tastes. Practical is the key word here. And in a way, you know, they correctly understand that often little true understanding is required for many workaday tasks.
They see this outlook as just simple realism.
And why wouldn't they continue these strategies? The most important reason they won't abandon what we call the critical strategies is simple.
It works.
Exactly. Why, after all, should anyone give up what works? They are just trying to survive and succeed within the system as it's presented to them.
Which leads us to maybe an uncomfortable truth.
Yeah, the faculty's unwitting complicity in this system. As Perry insightfully points out, it is through our grades that we describe for the students in the showdown what we believe about the nature of knowledge.
Grades send a powerful message.
And similarly, our assignments themselves broadcast our beliefs about what genuine disciplinary work actually entails.
So the tasks we set shape their understanding of the field.
Consider a history exam question like, analyze the main causes of the Spanish Civil War.
Okay, seems standard.
We routinely ask students to analyze, but what we often really expect them to summarize material.
Just list the causes they read about.
Right. And the definite article, the main causes, inadvertently invites students to treat interpretations as fixed information, even though historians know there are no fixed lists chiseled into marble.
It implies a single right answer, even when the reality is complex debate.
And this sets up contradictory messages, which I find particularly frustrating.
How so?
Students get maybe 20, 25 minutes for such a complex question on a midterm, which basically dictates simplicity and closure. Find the causes quickly.
Right. Not enough time for nuance.
Yet for term papers, they get weeks and maybe 20 plus pages for narrowly defined aspects. And they're told that a full analysis of something like the Spanish Civil War would take years.
So massive contradiction in expectations and constraints.
Yeah. The intellectually ambitious might figure out that exams are artificial, that they're just hoops to jump through. But the majority, they just seek to survive in the most energy-efficient fashion possible.
Which, again, reinforces those coping mechanisms, the clumps and shapes.
And when we receive papers full of these clumps or borrowed analyses, our common response might be comments like,
this means a bit more explanation.
Exactly. Or you just need to eliminate some of the things that don't apply. But our sources argue these answers are simply wrong.
They say we need something entirely other. It's not a tweak. It's a fundamental shift in approach that's needed. We're asking for the wrong thing.
So when we give a C+ to a superficial Birch's essay, we're essentially conspiring with students in a game of academic charades.
Ouch. Academic charades.
They pretend to grapple with our questions, and we pretend that they have grappled. This reinforces the idea that clumps of data and discussions that duck all the serious issues are close enough to thinking to pass for thinking.
It's a cycle of mutual reinforcement, and it's surprisingly effective for simply passing, like you said.
And there's a great paradox that highlights this. Most students, almost 98%, say grades are important.
Okay, they care about the outcome.
But many don't actually expect to excel. A C or C+ is success for them.
So the goal isn't mastery, it's sufficiency.
It reveals that many students are motivated primarily by the desire to survive rather than to excel.
Yeah.
To get through it.
And this whole dynamic, this focus on passing over understanding, it has ripples beyond the classroom, doesn't it?
Absolutely. This problem, which starts quietly in the classroom, actually extends far beyond it. Our sources highlight a growing societal issue with scientific illiteracy and, interestingly, scientific overconfidence.
Overconfidence? How does that fit?
They link this directly to the Dunning-Kruger effect, that tendency for people who are the least competent at a task to often rate their skills as exceptionally high.
Because they are too ignorant to know what it would mean to have the skill.
Right.
They don't know what they don't know.
Exactly. And let's be clear. Science is hard. Humans were not evolved to think scientifically, apparently, and it does not come easy for most of us. It requires constant vigilance, self-reflection, and the critical skepticism of knowledgeable colleagues.
That's why they're called disciplines, right? It takes discipline, rigor.
Precisely. This lack of intellectual humility, may be fostered by a system that rewards ersatz learning, unfortunately leads to a loss of respect for true experts.
You see that a lot. Our sources point out how photogenic and well-speaking experts in one domain pretend to talk authoritatively on another, which only further promotes this kind of widespread illiteracy.
Like celebrities giving medical advice.
Or, yeah, you see it manifest when people speak confidently outside of their domain of established expertise to make claims of certainty, for example, making false claims like vaccines cause autism.
Whereas an honest expert
displaying intellectual humility identifies the limits of current knowledge. They don't pretend to have all the answers. They'll say, we don't know yet, or the evidence suggests.
So how do we counteract this Dunning-Kruger effect, this overconfidence born from incompetence?
Our sources say it requires a civil and constructive Socratic interrogation, which, sadly, they note is becoming an endangered species.
Socratic interrogation.
Yeah.
Like questioning assumptions.
Exactly. True evaluation, true understanding demands the time and effort inherent in a Socratic discourse where you explain how one knows what one thinks one knows, not just picking answer B on a multiple choice test.
That sounds much more involved, much more authentic.
It is. It requires dialogue, pushing back, exploring reasoning.
Okay, that's a huge challenge, but where do we even begin applying this? For example, in biology education, there's often a struggle because it ends up being more about memorization than the thoughtful consideration and application of widely relevant ideas.
Yeah, naming the parts of the cell, memorizing cycles.
And this feeds into the very Dunning-Kruger effect we just discussed, right? Recognizing a correct answer on a test is vastly different from constructing a relevant, plausible, and verifiable explanation for how something works.
Absolutely different skills. So, to move beyond this, our sources propose a powerful solution, one borrowed directly from working scientists.
Okay. What is it?
Having students build and defend plausible explanatory mechanistic models, or PEMs.
PEMs. Plausible explanatory mechanistic models. Sounds complex.
It sounds it, but the idea is really about engaging in authentic scientific practice.
So what's great about these PEMs? What do they force students to do?
They force students to consider key questions. Are their assumptions consistent with basic chemical or physical principles? Does their model actually produce the expected behavior?
Okay, does it make sense scientifically?
Right. And how well does it predict system responses if you perturb it, if you change something within the system? Can it handle variations?
Ah, I see. So it's not just about getting one right answer.
Exactly. This process is brilliant because it immediately reveals misunderstandings. It forces students to recognize and apply relevant underlying principles, like, you know, actually understanding the difference between a hydrogen bond and a covalent bond and why it matters.
Instead of just defining them.
Right. The focus shifts from whether the model is simply correct to whether it works consistently with scientific principles and, crucially, if it can be revised based on evidence or critique. It's about the process of scientific thinking.
So instead of just memorizing isolated facts, like all the steps in glycolysis.
Right. The advice here is to teach core concepts. For example, in developmental biology, rather than getting bogged down in the specific minutiae of how development occurs in a specific organism, like a frog, students would focus on the principles behind how development occurs across different species. It's about understanding the underlying mechanisms, the general rules, not just individual facts about frog or fruit fly development, which might be unique to that species anyway.
Okay, focus on concepts over species-specific facts.
Exactly. A great example of a core concept is how biological systems respond to signals with threshold behaviors.
Threshold behaviors.
Yeah.
Like needing a certain amount of signal before anything happens.
Precisely. Think of something like slime mold cells responding only when a signal concentration reaches a certain level. Students often have a pretty fragile understanding of the molecular processes behind these switches.
They know it happens, but not really how it happens.
Pretty much. But with PEMs, you could have students build a model for how any biological system responds to signal, let's call it a signal response, PEM.
Okay. What would that involve?
They'd have to define the overall response, explain why there's little or no response below a certain threshold, and why it eventually saturates once all the targets, like receptors, are occupied.
So they need to think about things like receptor concentration, binding affinity.
Exactly. Those factors become part of their explanation, and they can use their model to predict how changes in these parameters might influence the overall behavior of the system. What happens if there are fewer receptors? What if the signal binds more tightly?
That sounds much more like doing science.
It is. This PM approach aims to fundamentally shift instruction. It means students learn to analyze processes, not just memorize details.
So less Krebs cycle memorization, more understanding energy coupling.
That's the idea. It emphasizes general principles over specific, isolated details. It means incorporating systems thinking, model building, and critically evaluating assumptions. It offers direct experience with authentic scientific practices without adding an excessive rote memorization load.
That sounds great, but it must require a totally different way of assessing students, right? You can't just give a multiple choice test on a PM.
Absolutely. And this kind of learning demands a complete rethinking of assessment. It moves away from timed high-stakes exams.
Things students hate anyway.
Right. Towards a process that's more like the preparation, peer review, revision, and eventual publication of a course dossier.
Like how actual research works.
Exactly. This changes the emphasis of assessment from simple right-wrong answers to truly evaluating the competency of learning how to perform a task, explicitly valuing reflective thinking and iterative improvement. Can they build a model, defend it, revise it based on feedback?
That's a big shift.
It is. So if we truly want to improve student learning, our assignments absolutely must meet specific criteria.
Okay, what are they?
One, they need to pose real questions, the kind of questions practitioners in the discipline actually address, not contrived problems.
Makes sense. Authentic questions.
Two, they must make scholarly sense within the student's actual time and space constraints. You can't ask for a PhD thesis in a week.
Right. Has to be feasible.
And this last point is arguably the most crucial. Assignments must challenge students to move beyond the content frame and to perform rather than simply to remember.
Perform, like apply the knowledge, build something, analyze genuinely.
Yes, because as we've seen, ERSAT's learning at its core is fundamentally reductive. It strips away true complexity and reduces understanding to something superficial. We need tasks that demand performance.
We need to stop seeing exams and assignments as mere collateral elements for evaluation, right?
Exactly. They profoundly shape the way students read and write and think in our courses. They are the curriculum in action in many ways.
So what's the best way to know if students really get it, if they have that genuine working understanding?
Well, the gold standard, according to our sources, is through Socratic, that is, dynamic and adaptive evaluations.
Back to that Socratic idea. Dialogue, questioning.
Yes. This is where students clearly explain, either to other experts or to other students, the source and implications of their assumptions. It's about demonstrating how they know, not just what they know. Can they articulate their reasoning? Can they defend it?
That sounds like true assessment of understanding.
It really is. And the ultimate aim here, connecting back to Dunning-Kruger, it's to move students beyond superficial familiarity and unwarranted certainty towards humble self-reflection and intellectual modesty.
Helping them understand the limits of their own knowledge.
Precisely. That's how we begin to address that pervasive Dunning-Kruger effect we discussed, cultivating intellectual humility.
Wow. Okay, so we've taken a really deep dive today into this surprising, maybe concerning reality that passing often doesn't equate to learning.
Yeah, and how this dynamic is perpetuated by both student coping mechanisms, the clumps and shapes, and crucially, by the very design of our educational systems, particularly inauthentic testing.
But here's the exciting part, maybe the hopeful part.
Mm-hmm.
By truly understanding these dynamics, particularly the subtle power of inauthentic testing, we actually gain leverage, right?
Absolutely. Understanding the problem is the first step to fixing it. The solutions, like embracing authentic tasks like PEMS and adopting more Socratic methods of assessment, they are well within reach. They offer a clear path to genuinely transformative learning experiences.
It's not impossible. It just requires a shift in thinking.
A significant shift, but yes, achievable.
So as you reflect on this deep dive, here's something to think about. What authentic tasks are you undertaking in your own life, whether it's work or hobbies, that truly challenge you to perform and understand rather than just remember or go through the motions?
That's a great question for everyone listening.
And maybe a bigger question. How might we, as a society, collectively shift our expectations of what it means to be truly educated? How do we move beyond the superficial, beyond just passing tests, to cultivate profound knowledge and, maybe most importantly, that intellectual humility we talked about.